From the trails, woods, and waters of the Great Lakes State to the Michigan Talk Network, it's Wild Michigan with your host, Duran Martinez.
Welcome to Wild Michigan. I'm Duran Martinez. Happy to have you here in the lion end of March. So it seems we have these nice days. Now we're gonna get some cold, wet days here towards the end of the month. But hey, that's all right, man. We got April coming up. Got walleye coming up here. We are being brought to you by our friends at Not Just Guns, Cedar Street at 127 in Mason. And I am firmly just absolutely convinced after my dealings with a air quotes big box store that is a warehouse for sportsmen's things. No, dude, small business is the way to go. And again, this is why we love Not Just Guns, man. By all means, check them out online, notjustguns.com. Check out their auctions and see them in person again in Mason. Is where you can go to find all the firearm needs that you have. Also want to thank our friends at Conquest Sense in Davison, Michigan, makers of VS1 and the Evercalm scent. Very important for deer hunting. And if they could make a turkey scent, if we really needed one, I'm sure they would do it. But fortunately, we don't. Thank goodness we don't. And we are getting ready for turkey season. That is coming up on the 23rd of April through June 7th. That is a bit of a pushback from normal, about a week, I think. But we're going to talk to our good friend and turkey expert, retired upland game bird specialist from the Michigan DNR, Al Stewart. How are you, sir?
Hey, I am great. I am great. Good talking with you, Durant.
You as well. Now, it'll be 1 year of retirement from the DNR coming up April 1st.
That's right. Yeah, April Fool's Day was right. My...
that's a day to go out, I guess. Hey, I'm leaving. No, really, I'm leaving.
But I was lucky to, you know, to work with the DNR for 50 years in some capacity, and... loved every minute of it.
You know, and that's fantastic. I mean, you had done so much with the turkey, with the wild turkey here in Michigan. And everywhere you go, I mean, you can really be proud of what you've done because it's so, I mean, they're just everywhere. I mean, literally into my backyard.
Yeah, turkeys are, you know, nationally one of the greatest wildlife conservation success stories. And you know, I was one, you know, small piece of a great big puzzle that put all this together, and many, many people in the Michigan DNR are, you know, what made it all work, and, you know, why we have a turkey season today when, you know, almost, you know, 60 years ago we didn't have turkey season at all. You know, 1954 was one of the first ones, and, or 64, I mean, is the first one, and, you know, look where we are now, so...
It really amazes me to see where we become, because I remember when my dad would put in for turkey hunting up in the Baldwin area was one of the places that you could go. But I mean, it wasn't by far down here at all.
Not at all.
And it's just amazing to see where we've come, and it's really nice. It's really nice to know that we now have a spring season and a fall season. You have your opportunity to choose whether it's a hen or a tom coming up in the fall, but in the spring season, it's a bearded bird. And boy, I tell you what, where my in-laws live, I see a lot of bearded hens. It's really kind of strange.
Yeah. About 10% of the hens have a beard. You know, they're legal. You know, you recommend people don't shoot hens because those hens tend to be some of the most productive. You know, it's best to shoot toms if you can. But you know, it's a legal bird, so there's nothing against doing it. And it's a unique, you know, very unique specimen. If somebody really wanted to have a bearded hen specimen, personally, I'd recommend shooting in the fall. But you know, if you want to, you know, go ahead. It's all legal. So,
Al Stewart is our guest here. He is formerly with the Michigan DNR, but forever an upland bird guy. I mean, it's just 50 years with the DNR, Al, you just don't walk away and go, I'm done. You know, that's it. But we've got a bit of a late start, April 23rd, about a week later than normal. Is there a reason for that, do you know?
Well, it's a varying, you know, it's set up to start on, you know, the Saturday now. It used to be the Monday closest to April 17th. And the reason for that is so that the majority of the hens have been bred before the hunting season opens.
Ah, okay.
So that weekend date or that Saturday or Monday all of a sudden, you know, causes it to shift around due to, due to leap year.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, and being on a Saturday, too, it gives a lot more people the opportunity to get out on the opening day should they choose to do so. And, of course, leftover licenses are available right now, and you can go to your retailer and pick them up if they're available in your area.
Yeah, if you didn't realize there was a drawing, you know, for some of these unique permits back in January, and you just all of a sudden saw a group of birds in the back part of your property or your friend's property, right now you can go and buy a license. So it's almost over the counter right now. There's leftovers for ones that had quotas, and then some of the areas like the private land only or the Hunt 234, which is open to hunting on private and public land in everywhere, but the like Region 3, Southern Michigan, and there it's just open for private land. So those are all open to people if they want to go. So it's a, you know, just getting out spring turkey hunting is some of the best turkey hunting or best hunting in my mind, you know, that's out there. And then you get this great piece of delicious meat, you know, to eat. I mean, it's, you get a Thanksgiving Day turkey. So, you know, there's nothing better than wild turkey meat. And I really like to, you know, hunt for the food side of it. Mm-hmm. And so I know where my food's coming from.
Absolutely. Al Stewart is our guest here on Wild Michigan. In a recent conversation I had with Tom Nelson, our good friend from the American Archer, one of his friends had said that, you know, turkey hunting has really taken over as his favorite type of hunting, even over whitetail hunting. And I agree with that for me personally. I really, really enjoy it. But again, it's a season that can last like 10 seconds.
Well, yeah, and so can deer hunting, you know. Depending
right,
on, if you know, if the magic works, it can be over really quick. You know, in any kind of hunting, usually, you know, about 90% of it is scouting, kind of trying to be in the right place at the right time, and the rest of it is harvesting the animal that you're after. So, but archery hunting has moved into it, and, you know, you were talking earlier about, deer scents and things like that, and it was once said that if a turkey could smell, no one would ever harvest one. You know, they have exceptional eyesight, phenomenal hearing. For an animal with a brain about the size of a pea, they are really, really smart and do all the right things at the right time. And those birds that, you know, right now you might see, you know, traipsing across the back property or part of your property and not necessarily paying attention to you, when hunting season rolls around or when you're hunting them, you know, they are looking for any little thing that's out of normal. You know, they live in the woods, you know, 24/7, and it's survival of the fittest out there. We go out once or twice, you know, a year and kind of think we know what we're doing, but the turkeys know what they're doing every day.
Absolutely. Al Stewart is our guest here, and Al, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna come back, talk to you a little bit more about the season coming up, and find out what you're up to now that you're retired but not stationary. I could never see you stationary, Al.
Thank you.
So hang on a second. We'll come back. We've got Al Stewart joining us, and we'll thank our friends at Conquest Sense for being a part of us here. Check them out online. You get a link directly to them, conquestsense.com, via our website, wildmichiganradio.com.
You can join us on Facebook or listen to podcasts, all from our website at wildmichiganradio.com. Now, back to Duran Martinez and Wild Michigan.
Cross the line at an altitude time. Interstate 94 more miles through the Great Lakes State. Turn it up so the bus ain't late. Another night in Michigan.
Welcome back to Wild Michigan. I'm Duran Martinez. Very happy to have you here. And if you've ever missed a show or are just finding us for the first time, make sure you check out the podcast at wildmichiganradio.com. And again, man, want to welcome all our friends in Florida, picking up the numbers over there. Also, California, Pennsylvania is our number two runner, believe it or not, Pennsylvania. And welcome our friends in Ontario and New Brunswick that I see. We are getting some traffic in there. And I'll be actually in New Brunswick coming up in September. Looking forward to that. Doing a little cruise up the East Coast with my wife, Sarah. And going to have a great time and see lots of great stuff. But right now, though, we've got the first real hunting season of the year coming up. Turkey season coming up on the 23rd of April, which I'm excited about. And that'll be a Saturday to get it underway. It goes till June 7th. And our go-to guy for the wild turkey here in Michigan is Al Stewart. And, of course, you can use these tactics about anywhere. Because it's essentially they're the same. It's just terrain is very different. And Al, when we go out, you know, I mean, look, movement is something we really have to watch out for. Of course, our camouflage is something we have to watch out for. But why is it we can put a pop-up blind in the middle of a woods or a field and that really doesn't bother them?
Yeah, I've never quite figured that all out. But there's some things that they skip a beat on, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, hunting Osceola turkeys in Florida or, you know, Merriam's out in Wyoming and Colorado. They seem to, you know, be able to skip over that a little bit. But even if you're in a tent blind, sometimes that little bit of movement, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, nah, I'm out of here. So, yeah, they sometimes have a problem, I think, like with depth perception. You know, it's like hunting mallards and using oversized decoys, and that seems to attract them more. But I, you know, I've had the good fortune to, you know, harvest a world slam of wild turkeys, and I actually am the only person in the world who has trapped for restoration or research all the species and subspecies of wild turkeys in the world. And, you know, doing that is kind of like a catch and release type of program, but you know, rather than having one turkey trying to come into you, trying to catch, you know, 10 or more birds with, you know, their eyes peeled for anything. So you have to be really, really careful. But you know, it's the same, like you said, anywhere, Duran, movement is really key to it. You know, I've always said the way to become a really good turkey hunter is to be halfway between where a turkey is and where he wants to go. So
you know, turkeys are just, again, they're so fascinating. And the variations, like you mentioned, the Merriam's is by far my favorite bird, though. I mean, all I've taken are those here in Michigan, but I've really yet to go someplace where I can hunt Merriam's, because that to me is a bucket list bird. But the oscillated is like cross turkey, cross peacock. I mean, it's really beautiful.
Yes. Oh, they're just beautiful birds, and, you know, it's fun to look at. And a guy by the name of John McRoberts, who's in Montana now, but did his graduate PhD work on them, and I went down and helped him, and he's probably the most knowledgeable person in the world right now about those turkeys. But they're really grand to see. They're in the jungle most of the time. Some of them have come down into the edges of some agricultural lands, you know, adjacent to the jungle. And they're really spectacular birds. So that was fun to go down and do those. But the Rio in Texas is great. They're just, You know, there's never a bad day of turkey hunting.
No. And that's just it. You can hunt hard and everything else, and it's still a great day. I mean, you get out and you see things, but, you know, whether it's run and gun or you're just sitting, honestly, man, nothing beats it. Or just calling for someone else. There's nothing that absolutely beats turkey hunting in my world. And you know, and again, you having the only world slam, that's pretty incredible for the catch and release, because I remember when that happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been fun. You know, like I said, I've loved my 50 years of working, you know, with the DNR and wildlife, natural resources, and I just can't say enough positive things about all the people I've worked with, both inside the DNR and, you know, with folks that have a passion for natural resources. It's outstanding, and it takes everybody to give a priority to natural resources and wildlife as well. So we have to all work together to make sure we get these things done.
Now, you have you are doing something new now. And as I'm looking back through our text, you're in Nebraska right now?
Yeah, actually, right now I'm out viewing the largest migration of wildlife in the world, sandhill cranes coming through Nebraska, and then I'm meeting with another couple people out here too. So how grand is that? And I've you know, there's over 600,000 sandhill cranes who come through a small narrow area along the Platte River of Nebraska. And before spreading out, you know, to breed in across Canada. I mean, just outstanding.
That's got to be loud and amazing at the same time.
Oh, it is. It is. And this little place that I'm staying at is right on the river where it's a night roost. And I mean, just thousands and thousands of birds come right in, like right next to you.
Now,
I mean, you and I couldn't carry on a conversation.
That's fantastic.
And hear each other.
Al Stewart is our guest here on Wild Michigan. Real quickly, Al, I have to ask you, are they really the ribeye in the sky?
They are. I have harvested them out west, and they truly are the ribeye of the sky. They're delicious to eat and, you know, challenging to hunt. So,
they must come down like a B-29. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, they're just really an outstanding bird, from, you know, both being able to observe and eating, you know, hunting and eating.
Sure.
So, and there's lots, you know, again, there's lots of them. So there's a lot of birds. For Michigan, the flyway is birds from Florida that come up, you know, into Michigan and up into Wisconsin. But for the most of the rest of the country, a lot of, you know, most of the birds come right through this little funnel point right here. So, and that's, you know, that's part of my, you know, this new job that I have, is to help inform citizens, people, about the contributions that hunters, anglers, and shooters make to conservation. So things like wild turkeys didn't happen by accident. You know, the restoration,
right.
You know, there was that time in Michigan in 1900 where they were completely eliminated, and hunters are who help, you know, restore these birds. And, you know, if you're out west, antelope were part of the same thing, or, you know, Canada geese and wood ducks. You know, it goes on and on, but these were species that were endangered, and, you know, now we call them the unendangered species, the ones that were about to go and are now very common.
Great. Al Stewart, right here on Wild Michigan on the Michigan Talk Network.
Nick Munch of Michael Waddell's Bone Collector, and you're listening to my main man, Duran Martinez, on Wild Michigan.
Rifle in a gun rack, hanging in the back glass, buck knife on my belt, ain't no lamp for sale around here.
Welcome back to Wild Michigan. I'm Duran Martinez, being brought to you by Conquest Sense. Find them online and via our website at wildmichiganradio.com. I want to thank Al Stewart for joining us. Of course, he is retired from the Michigan DNR, but he is the director of the Nimrod Education Center at Hillsdale College. And I'm looking forward to getting back with Al, because that's where our Olympic shooters are training and coming from, is down there. And that will be, I can't wait to talk to those guys. Our medal winners in the shooting did absolutely fantastic. And we're going to be getting down there to Hillsdale to do some interviews and maybe get some one-on-one time with them and Al down in the Hillsdale area. But in the meantime, we're going to speak to our good friend, outdoor writer and fishing guide, David A. Rose. How are you, sir?
I'm wonderful. How you been?
I'm doing okay, man. It was good. Al retired a year ago, and mm-hmm. and he is in Nebraska right now, observing the sandhill crane migration.
That's cool. I've actually seen that in first person too, driving through this time of year, and it's you look at, you're like, look at that big cloud bank. Ooh, looks like a nasty storm. And then you realize it's 7 million sandhill cranes.
And that's something. And he, of course, confirmed that they are truly the ribeye in the sky.
Yeah, I know.
I've heard of that, and I know people out west hunt them, or western, far west than us, farther west. We seem to be in this pocket of non-believers for some reason, with sandhill cranes and mourning doves things. People hunt them and people eat them, okay, and they protect them at the same time.
Yep, they do. Hunters are actually one of the most protective groups there is, you know, and a lot of people don't realize that. And unfortunately, the sandhill cranes, and we see more and more of them. In fact, I just heard two flying over my my house just yesterday. But they, and from what I understand, they can do a lot of damage to a farmer's field.
They,
you know,
do.
They really dig it up.
There are crop damage permits that you can get, and you know, I mean, look, they're gorgeous. Their song is like a pterodactyl, but you know, again, they can be managed safely.
Yeah.
So, again, I'm just putting it out there for those who just like to say, no, they're beautiful, don't touch them. But let's think about this through a scientific perspective, like we try and do. I mean, yeah, we get emotional about things, but we're people also. So,
right.
but let's talk a little below the surface with you. It's been an exciting day out in West Virginia. 51-pound muskie was taken from shore. And you and I kind of looked at the photo. Yeah, that's a big fish, but it looked a little stressed.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, just catching a fish really stresses a fish out. I mean, basically, I mean, on average, from what I understand, 10% mortality rate. So, you know, if you go out and catch 30 bass, well, there's a good possibility three of them might not make it, you know, and it's a shame. We love to catch and we love to release. And especially when you have a fish that big, they're old, you know.
Sure.
It's, you know, there's a lot of stress on an old body.
Yeah, boy, I'm finding that out day after day.
Yeah, just go mow the lawn once. You'll find
right.
out. Yeah.
Exactly. But, I mean, but again, look, that is not a species that's, you know, targeted mainly down there, I don't think. And you know, our guys on the big water, like St. Clair and whatnot, that do fish those, do know what it takes to get them revived and back. And
right.
again, this was just one of those lucky things that this guy got that fish and did release it. But, you know, there's
yep.
a lot of work involved in releasing, and not everybody knows that.
Yep. Looked like he was doing as best he could. He had a big tub there full of water. He waited for the DNR to come in. You know, they measured and weighed and then got it back in the water right there from the shore. And I do believe from the articles I've read, he was actually targeting muskie. He is a
really?
Muskie fisherman. Yeah.
Well, good. I mean, so he did know.
Yeah.
I mean, well, he had the tub, so there's some forethought right there. So
right.
hats off.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Now let's talk about Michigan DNR releasing earlier this week. Again, we get this ice out, and don't be surprised to see some fish kills.
Oh, correct. And, you know, it's one of those things. I, you know, every spring, you know, I'm in my mid-50s now. I've been fishing fool since I was, you know, 10 years old. Every spring I've seen fish kills, and there's so many reasons for that. It's not always some disease like VHS, you know, that came through mm-hmm. a decade ago or so. It's not always that. It is just the stress of spring. You know, the lakes, for an example, right now have the least amount of oxygen in them that they've had all year. You know, the plant growth is dead. There has been no wave action. Boom, all of a sudden the ice melts. You know, we all want the water to warm up quickly. And some of that, talking about stress, there you go. It stresses out those fish.
Yeah, and when we had the warm-up that we did, I said past tense, those 60-degree days where ice went out real quickly, that's got to do something to their, I mean, their balance, their internals, going from that really cold. Even though the water's not changing that fast, that ice and that cover is gone quickly.
Yeah, it's gone real quickly, and then all of a sudden, and it doesn't take much of a temperature change. I mean, 2 degrees, that's a pretty big stress when these fish have been in 32-degree water for the last, 4 months. It can be kind of stressful, and a lot of the fish spawn in the spring, too, so there's a lot of stress in just, the nutrients in the fish is going into creating eggs and milt and whatnot, and they haven't eaten as much in a while, and so yeah, there's another stress factor.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And again, the DNR puts that report out, but not everybody sees that report. Not everybody sees our Facebook page, but we try and keep you updated the best we can, and that's why we have David A. Rose on here talking about these things, and VHS too. That's something, if you've ever seen it firsthand or you've read about it, it can be a pretty nasty looking disease on these fish.
Oh, it can. I mean, the H stands for hemorrhage.
Right.
And that's what happens. I mean, these fish are actually hemorrhaging blood through their skin and out their scales, and it can look pretty nasty. Now, things seem to have really settled down with that a lot. But when it first came out, I mean, it was out east, I want to say, for a while, New York or something like that. Then, boom, all of a sudden it shows up in the Great Lakes and that. And I'll tell you what, the feds, they were saying no live bait. Because they were worried about VHS spreading via minnows or something like that when you're buying those and whatnot. And the state kind of went, whoa, hang on a minute. And at least they had it. So remember, everybody thought it was a pain, but at least you could have live bait when you had to, buy your minnows, save your receipt to show that you purchased those minnows from, the tackle place.
Right, yeah, exactly. And that was something, too. You had to have that receipt because the viral hemorrhagic septicemia that was being, released, that was a concern that the minnows might have been a vector for that.
Yep. And so, unfortunately, it's a natural disease and whatnot, and a lot of this stuff just happens naturally, and that's why lakes cycle. But I am glad to see that people are concerned about it if they live on a lake or something like that, and all of a sudden they see, 70 bluegills washed up on their beach there, and it's all the way up and down the lake. Yeah, maybe there is something, and it is good to call the DNR and just kind of, let them know about it.
Real quickly, too, one other news story that I caught wind of was a gentleman that was selling whole big head silver and grass carp in Wisconsin. Now, mind you, an Asian fellow, which in that culture, that is a food source, but selling any parts, that have not been degilled or one other method, completely no. And I don't think, frankly, he's getting the what he should get as far as punishment is concerned.
Yeah, I didn't see much about that, but I know it's happened in the past. And, all these species you just talked about, the big head and this carp and the Asian carp or whatever we call that now, and even the common carp came from Europe. That
sure.
Wasn't even here. The Europeans came over and they brought them over as a food source. So they are edible, and from what I understand, what they call the Asian, or did call the Asian carp, the silver carp now, I think, I can't even think what they call it now. But I guess they're very, very yummy.
I hear that, but, I'm not going to beat down anybody's door to find out. David A. Rose is joining us. We're going to talk a little bit about spring steelhead coming up next here on Wild Michigan on the Michigan Talk Network.
Hi, this is Cuz Strickland with Mossy Oak, and you're listening to Wild Michigan with Duran Martinez.
It sits above the mantle on a couple rusty nails, and it's worth a bunch of money, but it damn sure ain't for sale. The good Lord only knows all the stories it could tell granddaddy's
Welcome back to Wild Michigan. I'm Duran Martinez, being brought to you by Not Just Guns, Cedar Street 127 in Mason. And definitely when it comes to everyday carry or concealed carry, or looking for something upland game, or maybe even you want to start building your own AR platform, shop small and start with Not Just Guns, and you'll probably never want to go anywhere else. Trust me, I don't, and that's exactly why we're so happy to have them here. And that's where you can also find the American 100% made Henry rifles as well. And those are some beautiful, beautiful rifles. Back right now, though, we're going to talk fishing with David A. Rose, talk a little bit about steelhead. David, with the warm-up we had and the cool-down we're having, how is that affecting the steelhead run?
You know, it might actually help anglers a little bit. So, you know, things were starting to thaw, and we were, you know, our river's up. How's this? Our inland lakes, as you and I are talking, are still pretty much frozen up here, but they're starting to, I mean, you wouldn't want to walk on them. And we had a lot of snow in the woods, and we've got the rain. And, you know, it floods those rivers. Boom, you get all this just muddy water going in there. And that can actually cool the water down.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, why do we put ice cubes in our, you know, glass of water or iced tea, right? And we want to cool it down. So we got all this fresh water running through the snow, or just freshly melted snow, and it's cold. Well, now, you know, it's cooling off. The rains have slowed up. The waters will clear up a little bit, and the water temperatures will stabilize. They won't be dropping.
You know, and that's pretty important. I mean, you know, when you have consistency, water temp-wise, I mean, look, we know what that does for walleye, and, of course, that pretty much goes along the lines for steelhead as well. But when it comes to presentation, that cloudier water, how are we getting by with that?
Well, you know, we can... I mean, you know, floats for bobbers. They're very, you know, drifting a bobber through a run or whatever with a brightly colored jig is a real popular ploy right now. But one thing that gets overlooked is like inline spinners and spoons and, you know, plugs, something that not only is a visual, but that fish can hear and feel through their lateral line. So that spinning blade or that with the waggle of a, you know, some kind of a crankbait or plug like that. That's a good ploy when the water is up and muddier.
Now, what about size? Than something kind of small.
Yeah, you know, like I say, when we're drifting with the bobber and you got a jig, it's a pretty tiny little bait, you know, just barely the size of some aquatic critter that might be floundering down the river. But on average, I'm going to say if you had a spinner, size 4 blade, which some people go, wow, it's pretty big, that's going to be pretty standard when it comes to river fishing for, you know, salmon and steelhead and all that kind of stuff. You can go bigger. It's going to have a little more water resistance. It's going to have more thump. You know, and save the tinier spinners for bluegills or whatnot. Even when I trout fish in the summertime, I don't go under a size 3 blade. 3s and 4s are still my standard, and we get some beautiful brown trout casting spinners, you know, In the same places where somebody might use a size 0 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool. I mean, the different ways you can go about it and still be successful. I mean, look, you know, and I've said this a million times, the Panther Martin's always been my favorite, my go-to spinner. And I don't know what it is about that, why it's been more successful to me versus other types. I don't know if it's the shape of the blade or what, but that's always been my successful piece.
Yeah, you know, everybody, even when we're casting retrieving, we try and speed it up or slow it down or whatever, everybody still has their own cadence when they're reeling in. And so maybe that Panther Martin blade, which is a little longer and narrower, you know, when you're casting versus maybe something like a MEPS or a, you know, some are a handmade whatever that has a Indiana blade, which is a much wider blade and stuff like that. Perhaps that blade is, or that spinner blade is spinning, and that blade, the whole lure is right in the zone where you want it to be because of your retrieving speed.
David A. Rose is our guest here on Wild Michigan. David, let's bump it up a little bit to clearer water. I've seen where you may have like spawn, but up a little farther, maybe a fly like an egg-sucking leech or something. Kind of like a dual tactic.
Yeah, well, here's something I learned from biologists years ago when, as a writer and stuff like that. Trust me, I'm no biologist, but I get to learn from the best. And I was asking them, you know, when a fish goes in a river, obviously they're chewing on some stuff. You know, I've kept a few steelhead, for an example, and I always like to check what they've been eating, so I'll open up the stomach and stuff. And usually there's some bug matter in there, maybe some eggs in the fall or something like that. But there's been times it's just gravel and twigs. Because, you know, think about it, they're sitting in a river that's flowing by at 4 miles an hour,
mm-hmm.
And they're just darting out and grabbing things. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, in that soil water, that spawn bag that has a real nice scent to it, or even a whole crawler or something like that, is a good ploy because, you know, the fish can study it, can actually, you know, they can taste it coming down the river, you know, as they're sitting there. But, you know, in the faster water, so yeah, you know, don't be afraid to use flies or... When you say an egg-sucking leech, I mean, does a steelhead really think there's a leech sucking on an egg?
It's you for know? Us, David. We know that. It's more for us.
You know, and that leech could, you know, it's like a woolly bugger type-looking thing, and that can emulate so many different critters that swim in the water. So, But yeah, it's like anything. I've seen days where, you know, some kind of fly works over another for some reason.
You know, it's funny how indiscriminate they are. Again, like you said, it's not a lot of time to decipher, and it's not like they have that kind of capability either. You know what I mean? Just to go, that looks like a rock, so I better not.
You know, I use a lot of fake spawn. You know, it used to be Burl's Gold Nuggets or Super Spawn or K&E makes some, Bassstopper. They look like a spawn bag, but they're rubber. You mm-hmm. know, there's no scent to them or anything like that, and you just hook them on. And in really clear water, you know, using a float or whatnot, chartreuse. Now, how many chartreuse blobs of something is coming down the river? Well, obviously, my little rubber spawn bag, and I'll tell you what, I catch fish on it.
You know, that is a great point that you make. I mean, I don't recall ever catching anything Fire Tiger or Wonder Bread, but, you know, those, or dare I say, Monkey Puke. But, you
yes,
know what?
Monkey Puke, yes.
But those things, they work. It's something about that flash and the color pattern. And that's, again, why red and white has been so popular, just because of the contrast, I think, and the bright yep. color to it.
Yep. Contrast is a really important thing. I remember years ago reading an article in, like, Fishing Facts or something like that as a kid about why white is such a good color to use, no matter what. Always try a white something, you know. And it was just basically that, you know, you don't see too many pure white things going down a river or swimming through the water, but, you know, some might have silver and all that. But white, you can just see it. You can see it from all angles. And so, you know, there it goes, and they better eat it before it gets away.
You know, I'm glad you brought that point up, because the one time I actually got to go fishing with Dan Kimmel, I said, I am going to throw on a MEPS with a white, like a white furry skirt on it. You know, yep. and I'm going to throw it, and you know, he's fishing top water with some big rubber beaver thing, you know, going across the grass mats and whatnot. I'm catching fish while he's still casting, and he just looks at me and shakes his head, and he's like, you know what, I don't get it, but apparently it works.
Yep, I got a real quick MEPS spinner story. I was in a bass tournament years ago. Spinner bait bite was going on, but the bass, for some reason, the smallies were hitting the blades of the spinner bait, and they wouldn't hit that body. And I said, well, you want to hit a blade? I'll give you a blade. So I stuck a number 5 silver blade with the white bucktail on the back and proceeded to catch a whole lot of fish, including walleye and everything. You know, and my tournament partner just looked at me and shook his head like, you know, only you would even think about doing that.
Well, you know, whatever works, right?
You got it. And it's one of my go-to baits. It really is. I did an article for Walleye Insider years ago, and it was like the accidental walleye, and it was just about all these different kind of baits we catch walleye on that aren't known as walleye baits, and that spinner is one of them.
You know, and that's a great example, just to have something in your arsenal, everybody. I mean, just so you know, it's what you use and not expect to catch the biggest and the best fish. It can go back to Randy Howell using that Livingston red craw lure to win him the Bassmaster Classic when we were down there. And of course, I asked him, I said, what made you use that? You've never used it before. He's like, you know what? That's a great question.
Yeah, exactly.
But at least we were able to ask him that. And David, cool. As always, man, I appreciate your time and your expertise and things. And Like I tell Al, these things always go so fast, but we appreciate you joining us as always.
Yep, I appreciate it, and the bill will be in the mail.
Right, there it is. I'm broke as it is, David. Thanks.
I know.
David A. Rose joining us. Thanks to Al Stewart. And a whole nother hour coming your way. We appreciate you joining us here on the Michigan Talk Network. Thanks to Not Just Guns. Thanks to Conquest Sense. And my producer, Nathan Vandenberg, for joining us. And you especially. Check us out online, wildmichiganradio.com. Pick up the podcast and let us know what you think here on Wild Michigan.